From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made through a window where a young woman in Fairport would watch birds come to a feeder each day. Nicole Bielman loved birds. She loved nature, music, and people who knew her say she had a smile that would light up a room. Nicole Bielman died last month at the age of 27 when her father, who was her caregiver, fatally shot her, and then he turned the gun on himself. Bielman had a condition called Rett syndrome, a rare neurological disorder that left her unable to walk, talk, or use her hands. She is one of more than 400 people with a disability murdered by a family member or caregiver in the last 5 years. Bielman's uncle is quoted in the Democrat and Chronicle saying, "If you only knew what he went through and how much he loved her, it affected all their lives. I'm not justifying what he did. I'm just saying there are a lot of thoughts that go through people's minds, and until you've been a caregiver for 27 years to a child you know is not getting better, you don't know." End quote. Well, those comments reflect what disability rights advocates are pushing to change, how the murders of people with disabilities are reported in the media and discussed by family. They say those reports often dehumanize victims. Christina Kopic of the Rudderman Foundation, a nonprofit that promotes disability rights, says, quote, "If we are consistently faced with the portrayal of the killing of people with disabilities as a mercy killing rather than a murder, then the public opinion is shaped. So that is a problem. And given this problem, what are some of the best practices for journalists that they should follow?" End quote. Well, we're going to try to answer that question this hour with our guests in studio. And I want to mention to listeners, I mean, you're going to hear some tough stuff. We're going to be talking about some other stories. There are some specifics that will be difficult to listen to. There are moments where if you have kids around, this might not be. I just want to be sensitive to some of the discussion because we're going to be talking about other murders. We're going to call it what it is, but we're going to be talking about that. So just know that, please. Stephanie Woodward is the Director of Advocacy for the Center for Disability Rights, and it's nice to have you back, Stephanie. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Drake is a research analyst for Not Dead Yet. That's a disability rights group that opposes assisted suicide and euthanasia for people with disabilities. Stephen, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for asking me here.
Yeah, I want to start with just with this story and the fact that, you know, Nicole Bielman, I'm hung up on this quote by what her uncle said. And Stephanie, I'm going to start with you here. I want to know how that quote, you know, how it makes you feel hearing him say, you know, until you've been a caregiver for 27 years of a child you don't, you know, is not getting better, you don't know. I mean, he's not saying, I want to justify this murder, but it feels a little like that. I mean,
it's certainly sounding like he's trying to excuse it. And I have to say, I've been a disabled woman for 29 years. I'm not improving. My condition is never expected to improve. And my mother has yet to kill me. And there are plenty of parents of people with disabilities who do not murder their children. And I think it's important to note that this man was not the only person assisting his daughter. His daughter received services in the community where she had consumer-directed program assistance, which means she had attendant services. So it's not like there wasn't the help there. And even if there wasn't help there, the proper response is not to kill your child. And also, it's not to excuse the killing by blaming disability, because when you do that, you foreclose any possible investigation of other reasons why that murder may have occurred. When you blame the disability, there could have been something completely different going on there. I don't know. The father may have been trying to cover up something that the daughter knew about. I don't know, but we would never know if your first thought is to simply blame stress from being a caregiver.
Hmm. How do you feel about it, Stephen?
Well, there's a couple things. One is that brother is a highly suspect source. He had not talked to his brother in 20 years, and any information he had was secondhand. I found it incredible to build a story around somebody who's using it, whose account is 20 years out of date. The other thing is I want to reemphasize what Stephanie said. If there are these, you know, there are families all over the country dealing with all kinds of hardships, but we need to isolate the fact that none of these families are killing their kids. It's a very tiny percentage. And to put them out as somehow portraying this as inevitable and understandable really is an insult to all those families who are finding one way or another to cope.
Yeah, I think some of our listeners might be wondering if, what were the situations for these 400 plus murders? And Stephanie, I think said before the hour, but we should call it what it is, right?
It's absolutely.
Murder, homicide. What were the situations in terms of caregiving? I think both Stephen and Stephanie are making the point that, number one, you give no one a pass for murder, and number two, this was just happened to be a case where there was other caregiving help. But at the same time, do you think this is the appropriate moment to have that, or do we? It doesn't even matter if he was the only caregiver, right, Stephanie? I mean, I think it's important to talk about support services for families, but probably not right after a murder.
Absolutely, I think it's always important to talk about support services. Families with and without people with disabilities in them all need support at one time or another. And not to equate disabled people to babies, but like if you are the only caregiver for a newborn and you get frustrated, you don't kill them. The same goes for if you're the only caregiver for an adult with a disability or your mother who is declining in her health. The answer is never, I should kill this person to get rid of the stress in my life. Mm-hmm. And you should never excuse it in that manner. And yet that's how we do see a lot of reporters reporting on these stories, and it's an insult to our community.
Stephen, thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, in this area, we've had a lot of children being killed by parents and caregivers over the last year. And I'm sure the majority of them were in some kind of crisis that needed some kind of support. You'd find very troubled people with an awful lot of problems. But we don't try to normalize what they did, the actions that came as a result, because we know many people are struggling with the same problems, but they don't commit murder. And we somehow set that aside often with disabilities. Aside from children with disabilities, the other area this takes place a lot is in the cases of elderly homicide suicides. The perpetrator's usually male, and it's more often than not framed by the press and the public as a mercy killing.
Yeah, that term is just so difficult to hear. But in a moment, I'm going to take our first phone call because we are going to talk about what the justice system does here. But I want to also just stress another point here. When we talk about a mercy killing, you know, Stephen's group that you work with, we're going to talk more about the mission of Not Dead Yet and what the group is doing as we go throughout this hour. That term, does it turn your skin, Stephanie, mercy killing?
I don't think there's any excuse for murder, and mercy killing is just a way to romanticize what is murder, and we do see this romanticization of it, especially when you see these elderly couples where, oh, the husband didn't want to see his wife suffer, so he killed her and then killed himself. Isn't that romantic? They died together. No, that's domestic abuse, and that's murder.
Yeah. Bruce in Irondequoit on the phone has a comment about the legal system, and I think it's a good time to turn to that. Let's start with Bruce. Go ahead.
Well, there are different reasons and different aspects of someone dying. It's not always, there is not just murder. There's justifiable homicide. There's all these other pieces. There's first-degree murder, second-degree murder. And I'm kind of hard-pressed to see what we're trying to accomplish with this discussion. I don't think anybody romanticizes it. They did what they did, and it's explained out. And I don't see anybody getting away with anything because they killed
Bruce.
Somebody. I don't think anybody's gotten off. No more than I think that any woman who's been abused should be able to kill, they should get out of there.
All right,
if it's right in the middle of abuse,
yeah.
Then yes, you need to defend yourself, but if not, if you kill them afterward and plan to kill them, it's not right.
All right, so
I don't see anybody getting away with that.
Bruce, wait. I'm going to put you back on hold because I'm glad you bring up this point because essentially you're wrong, and I'd like to demonstrate how you're wrong. And I don't mean to be rude, but I think you're making an assumption that's probably logical. You would think, okay, well, homicide, murder, I mean, this happens and it's sad, but people don't get away with it. But they do, in a sense, and I'm going to explain how in just a second here. Stephen brought up the word normalize. So one thing that happens is when the media reports on these cases and emphasizes, well, the uncle said, you know, it's just so hard. You don't know what it's like to be caring. Well, then the fear is not just the lives that have been lost, but potential lives lost to come. Then there's the question of what the justice system does. I want to read, and I'll come back to you, Bruce. That's why I put you back on hold. But let me read this, and we'll get our guest thoughts, and we'll see what you think, Bruce. Here's a Huffington Post headline from earlier this year. And the headline is, "How Murder Victims with Disabilities Get Blamed for Their Own Deaths. A Disturbing Number of Caregivers Kill the People They're Meant to Be Helping." And this is tough stuff, but I'm going to read it. Quoting from their story, quote, "Alex Sportolakis was 14 when his mother and godmother decided to kill him. The woman tried to poison the boy who had autism with sleeping pills. When that failed, Dorothy Sportolakis stabbed her son 4 times in the chest with a kitchen knife. She hit his heart 2 times. She cut one of his wrists so deeply she nearly severed the hand, according to court records. Now, a year later, a second case, 11-year-old Rishani Kohli, another child in Illinois. Similar place. Died from a stomach rupture when his mother, Nicolette Lawrence, punched her repeatedly. The autopsy revealed scars and old injuries indicating continual physical abuse from the mother to the child. Now, Alex, the boy, was killed in 2013. Rishani, the girl, killed a year later. Both were slain by people entrusted to protect them. But the respected outcomes of these first-degree murder cases, one involving a child with disabilities, the other involving a child without medically documented handicaps, speak volumes about an insidious bias in the justice system. Because Alex's killers pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter, they served 3 years each before they were sentenced to time served, and they were released. Rishani's killer, meanwhile, was convicted of murder and is serving 43 years. Advocates for the disabled say such disparities are common in the legal system that seems to treat accused killers less seriously if the victim was a person with special needs who depended on the person charged with murder. On average, at least one disabled person is killed each week by a parent or a caregiver, according to a Rudderman Family Foundation report." So again, Bruce, I'll come back to you in a second. That is one story. That's an anecdote. Two young people killed by their caregivers, one with a disability, one not. In the case with a disability, 3-year sentence. In the case of a child without a disability, 43 years. And what the Rudderman Family Foundation says is that happens all the time. Stephanie, what do you think?
I think these are demonstrative of what we see all the time. And as a disability rights attorney, I'm not in the criminal justice system, but I am well aware of the difference between first degree, second degree manslaughter. Point is, these are murders. These are not accidental killings. And yet we see parents that either don't even go through the justice system, even though it is very well documented that they killed their child, or they receive lower sentences. Some people have received probation for murdering their child. It is sad to see when a mother drowns her autistic child in a bathtub, not even get a year in jail.
Stephen?
Yeah, we see that. I'm using another anecdote. A few years ago in Austin, Texas, a woman killed her disabled husband by putting an overdose into his IV. And she made it clear he didn't want to die. He wanted to live, but she did this anyway. The court gave her probation for intentionally killing her husband with an overdose, somebody that not only, didn't he give permission, but he actively wanted to live. And yet the court there in Austin, and we all know the reputation of Texas when it comes to sentencing, decided to give her probation. There's also the effect it has on other similarly situated families. In Chicago, about 10 years ago, we had an incident where a woman around Peoria, in Tazewell County, killed her 4-year-old daughter who was autistic. And there was about 3 months worth of very sympathetic coverage of this mother, in spite of the rest of the family begging the press to stop, because they all loved the child and said the problem was not with the child, it was with the mother. Well, after 3 months, this county, which had not had a homicide in over 10 years, had another woman attempt to kill her daughter with developmental disabilities. And you have to wonder, given in any kind of parenting, at any given moment, there are a number of people in crisis and contemplating awful things, but they won't do them. Does the idea that murder, the unthinkable, is being treated sympathetically enough to throw somebody else over the edge?
All right, so let me go back to Bruce, and I wonder if that changes your mind about the outcomes here and why we're having this conversation. What do you think, Bruce?
That make a very good case, but I don't know that statistically there aren't other situations where the same type of thing comes up where there's poor sentencing because of the justice system or over-sentencing because of the justice system. So absolutely, anybody who's committed that should be prosecuted fully.
Bruce, thanks for the phone call. I mean, there's no question that occasionally the justice system gets something wrong, and there's a lot of well-intended people who occasionally get it wrong. But the larger point is that when you analyze these cases of murder of people with disabilities, more often than not, on average, that sentence is shorter, sometimes no time served at all, because there is a disposition that says, boy, it's just hard to care for people with disabilities. And, you know, they snapped, but they must have loved them. It must be hard for everybody. And when that happens in the court system, and when the media reports it that way, the concern is there's not justice, and there may be more to come. Exactly what Steven just talked about, in a place where no homicides in 10 years, and all of a sudden you've got a homicide and then an attempted homicide. So Bruce, thanks for the phone call. I'm going to get back to your phone calls in a moment here. I want to ask both of our guests, you know, what we can start to do about it, because I'm probably part of the problem. I got to go back and look at the way I've reported on these stories, and I can at least thankfully say I can't remember too many specifically that I've covered, but we know they are out there. And of course, there was that case in Fairport a month ago. So I don't know what I've said, but I want to ask them what they think people in media seats like mine can do better, and how we report these stories. So I'll start with Stephanie Woodward. What do you think?
I think that you need to remember that other people with disabilities are reading this, and you should write in a way that you would not offend that person. I specifically remember growing up when I was a child, when Tracy Latimer from Canada was killed. She had a disability very similar to mine, and I remember the reporting was very sympathetic to the father who murdered her and saying it must have been hard. She used a wheelchair, like she was young, and it must have been very hard. And I remember hearing those reports and thinking, I'm in a wheelchair. Like, what if my mom does this to me? And it really can lower the self-esteem of a person and make them feel like a burden. And when you feel like a burden, you're more susceptible to experiencing abuse and not reporting that abuse because you think you deserve it. And it can lead to higher rates of domestic violence against women with disabilities. And there is a significantly high rate of domestic violence against women with disabilities. So, and watch the language you use. Saying that people were burdens or that they were confined to a wheelchair, that's so offensive. I'm not bound to my wheelchair. I'm not wheelchair bound. The whole point of wheelchairs is to move. Being bound is not something you ever say when it's something that is good in your life. And yet for wheelchair users, our wheelchairs are good in our lives because it helps us get out into the community so we don't have to just sit on our couch all day. So language is very important, and always refer back to disabled people in these stories, because we are the experts on our own lives.
And Stephanie, you also just mentioned an important point we have yet to get to, which is we're talking about murder. We're talking about homicide this hour. But abuse also happens at a higher rate in the disability community, right?
Absolutely. And when you start with abuse, it can eventually lead to murder. Not always, but there are signs that can get there. So we need to stop it before it even begins.
In the same way that we talk about someone who killed someone in their care, sometimes a parent and a child, and say, well, but it must be hard, so you know, it's sad, but imagine someone who strikes a child or someone in their care, and they say, well, you know, they snapped that day, they probably didn't mean it. The more we start to normalize, the more we probably put people with disabilities at risk.
Right? Absolutely, and the more you normalize, the more you tell caregivers that, hey, you might get a pass too.
Yeah. Stephen, what do you think?
Oh, I totally agree.
Get right on your mic there for me, Stephen.
Oh,
thanks.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
When we one thing that could help with the reporting is to not separate these murders out of the context of other murders. If we're going, you know, if we talk about the murders of children with disabilities, family members with disabilities, as though there's something different than other domestic violence and homicide, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in how the public, the press, and the courts are going to treat it. We'll get a two-tiered system. Well, I got a many-tiered system. You get different kinds of justice for different kinds of people, but you formalize it then. You've got a public that's willing to sympathize with the killer, which, you know, of course is going to factor into a prosecutor's decision. So they'll go for something lower because they're afraid they won't win the case in court. And all of these factor in. And the media, the press, the reporters play an important role in how we are seen.
Well, I want to get back to your phone calls on this subject. This is Keith in Farmington next. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. A couple quick comments. I think when you showed the when you mentioned about the two different outcomes for the similar cases mm-hmm. of murder, mm-hmm. I think what basically happens is you have different juries, and that's where the problem lies, because I have firsthand knowledge of a trial that they basically wanted to plea to first-degree manslaughter. The DA said, no, we're going to go second-degree murder, and the jury came back third-degree manslaughter. And the other thing is, we in society, we're ingrained to value people's lives differently. To give you an example, if a police officer were to get killed while working, his funeral is way different than if I were to get killed while working or if I was murdered on the job. We as society look at different people and judge their lives differently.
Is that okay?
That's really sad.
Hold on, though. I know you're making an observation. I can't tell if you are endorsing that idea.
Oh, no. I'm just making an observation. That's where the problem comes in because, I mean, look, I'll give a simple thing. Healthcare. I mean, if we all live to retirement, there's going to be certain people are going to get way better health care when they retire than other people. When certain people die on the job, if a construction worker dies on the job, there's a funeral for him, his family, maybe some coworkers. If a fireman dies on the job, there's a huge outpouring of support. Now, to me, all their lives are valued the same, but they're all treated differently. And I think that's what happens. And it shows up when you have a jury, you have somebody with a disabled, well, they're not as good as somebody else. And I think that's how it shows itself, or that's how it gets played out.
All right, Keith, I thank you for the phone call. I now understand the point that you're making. I think I was uncomfortable with it, but I understand the point that you're making, because I know you're not endorsing that. But I think that's some of what our guests are trying to change. Maybe they wouldn't disagree that right now our society views people in different places and different work lines of work, different abilities and disabilities differently. But the goal is for that not to be the case. I mean, Stephanie, what do you make of Keith's call?
I think that he's absolutely right. We value people in different ways. And one of my biggest problems is that throughout society, not even with just murder cases, but in general, we devalue the lives of people with disabilities. We treat people with disabilities as less than other people. I mean, common everyday circumstances, if there's a front entrance that's inaccessible and a back entrance through a kitchen that is, people will say, well, what's the problem if a wheelchair user has to go through the back? But if you had to go through the back, a non-disabled person, you would have outrage because why should you have to go through a second class entrance, but it's okay for a disabled person. And that just gets amplified when it comes to cases of abuse, of murder, that, well, it must have been hard for the non-disabled person to help the disabled person. Therefore, it's excusable because we don't value the disabled person, so we'll excuse the non-disabled person.
Keith also mentioned healthcare. Anything you want to mention about healthcare and how a healthcare system views people differently?
Well, I think that it's not a secret that ADAPT spent the majority of this summer fighting to save Medicaid because they're...
Can I mention, do you mind if I...
Absolutely.
I don't mean to interrupt you, because I want our listeners to understand who you're hearing from. Stephanie Woodward is... didn't know this was going to happen, but Stephanie's been involved in many different efforts, advocacy, sometimes protests, demonstrations regarding healthcare, regarding rights, and a photo of Stephanie went viral earlier this. When was that, by the way?
I believe it was June.
It was in June. And you want to remind our listeners what you were doing?
We were fighting the first iteration of the Senate's bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which included over $8 billion in cuts to Medicaid, which is the primary insurance carrier that covers people with disabilities and allows us to live. And $800 billion would result in a lot of lost lives of disabled people. So we may or may not have been dragged out of Senator McConnell's office and carried by Capitol Police to jail. And that's what it meant to us, because we would rather go to jail than die.
Well, and so Stephanie, is that image of Stephanie not only went viral, was a galvanizing moment. I mean, it was a very powerful national moment with Stephanie Woodward's image there. And Stephanie is not one to say, look at me. She's saying, look at the issue. But that was a very, very powerful issue, image. So just to kind of put a bow on that, you think the healthcare system values lives differently?
Absolutely. People who can afford nice healthcare are people who deserve to live. But people who can't are apparently people who deserve to die. And we have a system that gives lower quality care to people who are living in poverty, people who have disabilities, and we're more willing to cut those services to those people who we view as a drain on society.
Okay. Stephen, some thoughts on Keith's phone call about how we value people differently in society.
Well, it's obviously true. We know that people of color get treated differently. We know that women get treated differently. You know, I recognize those things and follow a lot of it. But the fact is, I'm not black, I'm not a woman, and there's enough white people trying to represent black people and enough men trying to represent women already without me getting into the mix. So I'm doing what I can do, which is being one of many representatives of the disability community, because that is where I live. You know, talking about healthcare, another thing that feeds into this is that there are actually medical people who don't object to us getting less. You know, my whole life has been against medical advice. The doctor who delivered me here in Strong told my parents it would be better if I didn't survive that first night. And that, you know, I probably wouldn't walk, wouldn't talk. The usual thing they talk about when they want to leave a baby in the corner of the nursery to die. It's not a new phenomenon. There's always been a subset of people in medicine who feel comfortable about choosing what lives are worth living and whose aren't.
All right, listeners, we're due for our only break of the hour. I want to thank Dr. Elizabeth Murray on Twitter, who sends a note to us from the American Academy of Pediatrics. A study dating back to 2007 finds that developmentally disabled and intellectually disabled children and abuse. And so here's that stat. Children with disabilities are 2.2 times more likely to be sexually abused and 1.6 times more likely to be physically abused. Again, we're not even talking homicide or murder here. We're just talking about abuse that happens in so many different forms. So if you're just joining us, what we're talking about today is the layered ways that people with disability suffer when it comes to how some of these really difficult and gruesome stories are reported and tried in the justice system. According to the Rederman Foundation, more than 400 people with disabilities have been murdered by caregivers in the last 5 years. That is a tremendously high number in this country, and one of them right here in our area in Fairport just about a month ago. It was a 27-year-old woman shot and killed by her own father in her backyard. And what we know is that the justice system tends to give lighter sentences, sometimes much, much lighter, when caregivers are behind these crimes, often because of this idea that, well, it was tough. It was hard. We also know that the media, probably me included, don't let me talk from the mountaintop. I mean, we're all part of this, talks about these issues in a way that sort of normalizes or kind of waves off the gruesome nature of these murders because of that same idea. And when we do that, we sort of dehumanize the victims and we set more possible abuse and worse up. in the future. So our guests are talking about that with us this hour. Stephanie Woodward from the Center for Disability Rights. Stephen Drake is here, and he's going to tell us in our second half hour more about what Not Dead Yet is. It's a, largely speaking, a disability rights group that opposes assisted suicide and euthanasia for people with disabilities. We'll take more of your comments as well after our only break of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Charter Schools. A new film takes a look at charter schools in both Philadelphia and New Orleans. New Orleans is a city that went almost entirely charters after Hurricane Katrina. So what have the results been? We'll take a look at what the film shows us and the broader question on what the goals of charter schools are versus how they are often carried out in reality. It's all coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll come back to your phone calls in just a moment. Let me read a comment from Gary, who asked a question. Gary says, is there a distinction between justification, excuse, and reason? Doesn't understanding the reasoning of the killer in these situations help lead to solutions? He says, there seems to be a blurring of terms. Understanding a reason is not being sympathetic. So Stephanie Woodward, I think what Gary is saying, and I don't want to speak for him, but I think what he's saying is if we say that the reason that Father in Fairport or somebody else in any of these hundreds of murders, if we say that the reason is because that they gave was they were burned out on the caregiving, that Gary's saying that doesn't necessarily automatically mean we are sympathetic to it or wave it away, but we want to understand motive. Is there a difference, and do you agree?
I think that I agree that we shouldn't assume that the reason was disability. As I was saying earlier, we don't know what this man's reason was as of right now because he killed himself as well. So the police reported an assumption that it was caregiver stress, and that assumption forecloses any possibility of a thorough investigation of what might really have been going on there. It perhaps wasn't caregiver stress at all, and this girl is not getting the justice that she deserves when we blame that, when it could have been something completely different. There could have been other forms of abuse going on. There could have been a secret we're trying to keep. I don't know. But the point is, when you blame that caregiver stress, you are foreclosing an investigation of other reasons.
And I think what Stephanie is also indicating is it's almost automatic in these murders that we blame caregiver stress, without taking the time to actually understand it. Now, Gary might say, okay, but let's say even if it's, you know, just a smaller percentage, but let's say the father in this case in Fairport was here to tell us, you know, that's why I did it. Can we report it and discuss it and adjudicate it in a way that doesn't also give it sympathy?
I think that we shouldn't consider the fact that knowing the reason is giving it sympathy. But when we say caregiver stress was the reason, we end up giving sympathy. And you say, well, there should be more supports. In fact, there are plenty of supports out there. And there are supports that are offered to these families, which we have seen in other cases where a parent has murdered a child with a disability or a child has murdered their parent with a disability, where the supports were there, the supports were offered, sometimes the supports were taken, and they still do it. So when I listen to a person say the reason I did this was caregiver stress, I kind of want to call bull, because whether you're stressed or not, it's not an excuse for murder. And when you had the supports available, there might have been something else going on, and you're not telling the full truth about it, and you're looking to use this as an excuse for sympathy.
In the same way, by the way, that workplace stress doesn't get any sympathy when someone kills a coworker.
Absolutely. If you're stressed, you deal with your stress. You don't go and kill somebody.
Okay. So thoughts on that, Stephen, before we go back to the phones?
Yeah. One thing is about 50% of parents who kill their kids say they did so for altruistic reasons. Somehow, in their own heads, they did it for their own good. The only time we entertain that claim seriously is when the victim is disabled. The other thing is, going back to the Beilman case, we do know there was something else in play. A search warrant had been executed. At least one reporter I follow on Twitter has said that he knows enough about it to say he suspects it was a factor in the murder. But we'll never know. So we're left with just contemplating or mostly forgetting what that search warrant meant and might have meant, and looking, again, all at the victim and her as a burden.
All right, back to the phones we go. Lauren in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi, Evan. I want to start out by saying that this is bringing up a lot for me. As the parent of a child who passed away at the age of 16, she had multiple disabilities throughout her life, and it was an absolute delight. I really, really appreciate the way that you introduced the woman in Fairport as a whole person. When my daughter was growing up, I frequently had to make sure that she was seen by the medical community as a whole person who was valued by her family. And I wanted to talk in particular about an incident that happened about a year before she passed. She had a respiratory infection, and during that time developed some difficulty feeding and eating independently, which she'd always done. And she was discharged from the hospital, and we brought her to our family practice doctor with the intention of getting some support and some advice and some referrals for some additional care that my daughter would need. As we started to go into what it was that we were going to need for her, some referrals for a GI specialist, some nursing help, that sort of thing, which we'd been told to do by our palliative care doctor, who was extremely helpful, and by the people in the hospital when she was discharged. So we were going and doing what we had been told to do in order to try to get our daughter better if she could get better, with the knowledge that her lungs were failing and that a time would come that probably she wouldn't get better. My husband and I were there, and the doctor didn't look at our daughter. She focused entirely on us and interrupted me to ask me how my heart was, what my doctor would think of all that we were doing and what kind of stress it was putting on our lives. And then she asked how far we wanted to take this, this being the care that we were giving our daughter. And it was shocking, and we didn't know what to do. I wanted to walk out, but I couldn't walk out. We needed her to be able to make the referrals. And so we just pretended that it wasn't happening. We said, we think that she can get better. We've looked at end-of-life issues. We already, we know that the time may come that she can't get better, and when that time comes, we'll deal with it, but we're not there yet. And then she didn't make the referral for nursing. She didn't make the referral to the GI specialist, and she didn't make any of the other referrals that we needed for support. She simply did not make them. And it took me months. It was 11 months before we got nursing care. And I followed up with a doctor by phone afterwards because I wanted to make sure that she wasn't trying to introduce the idea of how we wanted to handle end-of-life care. What I said with her when I followed up was, were you talking about how far we wanted to take this when the time came that she wasn't able to survive and how we might want to handle her passing? Or were you talking about whether we wanted to get her better right now? And she said that she didn't see a difference. That to her, there was not any difference between providing care for a person with disabilities who had the possibility of getting better and care for a person with disabilities who was actively dying. And so I wanted to share that. And then when I questioned that, she told me that she wasn't comfortable caring for us as a family if I didn't like the way that she had handled that. And she essentially told me she was firing me from the practice without having made any referrals at all.
I'm sorry, Lauren. and I know it's not easy to share this kind of a story. And I don't want to indict the entire medical community, but I also know that just based on the feedback we're getting in various forms, that this kind of story is not an outlier. So stay there, Lauren, if you could. Stephanie has some thoughts for her.
Okay. I mean, it's devastating to hear this, but at the same time, I'm almost numb to it because I hear it so often. And it hurts to know that. It hurts to know that my parents were told when I was a child, well, I mean, is it worth it to you to keep getting care for your child? And it's not unlike the medical community to deem what lives are worth living and what aren't, and for the disability community to often be in that not worth living category. And very much like the murderers of people with disabilities saying, I did it for their own good. What kind of quality of life would they have had? These are the same decisions that doctors are making, but because they have a degree, we're giving more weight to those decisions. And it also plays a part in how we view the murders of people with disabilities when we have doctors endorsing this idea that disabled lives aren't worth living.
Lauren, can you just stress one more time for us? I know, you know, Nora's gone, but it was, you said it was a joy that can you tell us again?
She was an absolute joy to everyone who knew her, including every doctor that got to know her. And many, many doctors found her an absolute joy. And if not for the 30-second spiel that I developed that I would give every time I met a doctor in an emergency room or as we headed into PICU, the times that she had to be there, they might not have seen her there. And parents of typical kids don't have to enter a medical, a medically emergent situation with a 30-second spiel about how valuable their child is. They just don't.
Lauren, thank you. Again, I know it's not easy to share this. Thank you so much for taking the time to call and for, again, telling us not only the difficulty, but the joy of a parent of a child with a disability. And that's an important word, joy, because the system puts a lot of emphasis on the struggle. But there's also joy. I mean, of course there's joy. Of course there's. I mean, so that's important phone call. I got a lot of feedback here, and I'm looking at the clock going, wow, it's 12:50. So let me try to work through as much as I can. Next up is Sarah in Rochester. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say I'm also the parent of a severely disabled child. He's in a wheelchair and is fairly intellectually disabled as well as severely physically disabled. And I really, really appreciate your two guests and everything that they do, especially the fight for Medicaid. It's really, really horrifying for families like ours when people talk even a little bit about making any kind of cuts to something like Medicaid, because it's literally all that keeps our family afloat. My husband and I are both college educated and try to work as much as possible given our son's needs. So I appreciate everything they're doing, but I also just feel like I need to say something about the way that some of this is being talked about, which is, of course, I would never in a million years justify anyone doing anything resembling murder, and if that obviously it should be punished to the full extent of the law. But I think there's a little bit of a falsehood to the idea that there's plenty of supports and that all you have to do is access it or ask for help and you'll get it. My son is a mid-teenager now, and over those years, we have become, as a family, more and more isolated, and it is just not true that even with all of our education and resources, we often cannot get the help that we need. He's had two major surgeries, other hospitalizations. We have no friends or family in the area. We've lost friends over the last 15 years that he's been alive because people just don't like being around families that are like ours because there's a lot of suffering for our son, for our daughters. And when we asked for help and support around the time that he had one of his major bone surgeries, we just didn't get any. We could get some nursing help, but in the end, we had to take family medical leave and just do round-the-clock care. And it's isolating and it's horrible, and nobody wants to talk to you about it. Nobody wants to know about it. There is respite, but go ahead and try and access that to get quality respite care. My son is aware when people want to take care of him versus when they're being paid $8 an hour or two. And he will not go to places like that. We cannot get respite when we need it. My husband does 24/7 care of him every day of his life. And I'm in no way justifying any form of violence, but I know the desperation and loneliness that comes from being isolated in this way.
Sarah, thanks for the phone call. Stephanie, can I start with you? She's expressing in one way also some frustration that support isn't always available or doesn't always feel close.
I can completely understand that. And in the circumstances I was talking about specific cases where we know that the support was available and it was offered and it was denied by the families. And oftentimes some families deny support because they think taking the support somehow shows that they are not able to do it. And they take that as a a dig to their dignity. But mm-hmm. in the disability community, we recognize that there is not enough support. In fact, we are regularly involved in policymaking to provide more support to families and more recognition of those workers who are paid to do their work, because sometimes you don't get quality respite care because the person is being paid so low that they kind of took anyone who applied for the job. Whereas when you're helping someone with a disability, like, live their lives, you should be paid well to do so. So we work on a state and a federal level to increase wages. The Center for Disability Rights is regularly, on Wednesday, we were at the governor's office demanding higher wages for attendance services. And we also helped draft the Disability Integration Act, which is a bill that would require any insurance company that would pay for a person to live in an institution to also live in the community and to pay fair wages to people who are helping the people with disabilities and to not require informal support. And informal support is when you basically require a family member to do it simply because they're there. And, you know, some people with disabilities don't want their family member being the person that supports them. And some family members don't want to be that person, or they don't want to be that person all of the time, which is why we are always working for better supports for the family member, because the family members and caregivers, if they get better supports, the disabled person is getting better support as well.
Sarah, thank you. Thanks for the reminder and just the making sure that we're aware of the challenge and the struggle. I appreciate that, and I wish you and your family luck. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking the time to call. Andy in Lima wanted to ask, and I want to direct this to Stephen Drake. What does your panel think about euthanasia? Well, Stephen Drake is research analyst for Not Dead Yet. That's a disability rights group that opposes assisted suicide and euthanasia for people with disabilities. Down to about our last 2.5 minutes, but it's a good time to tell Andy in Lima how you feel about this issue and what your group does. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, we're opposed to euthanasia for any reason. We have a And by that, I mean the direct ending of a life by lethal injection, whatever. It has a bad history. I got into this basically through watching a Canadian case of a child being killed, Tracy Latimer, being used by pro-assisted suicide groups in Canada as a way to boost their own cause, which was kind of confusing because up to that point, they'd been all about, oh, no, what we want is euthanasia-assisted suicide for competent adults who can clearly ask for it and who are dying. Well, all of a sudden, they're embracing this guy who gassed his 12-year-old daughter. He put her in the front cab of his truck, piped exhaust into the front seat, and watched while she died, tried to pass it off as a natural death. Anyway, this got embraced by the regular assisted suicide groups in Canada, and it became part of what they advocated for. And that's why when Canada passed assisted suicide and euthanasia last year, it's not confined to just terminally ill adults who can ask for things. The door's wide open on children and people with different kinds of disabilities.
And you fear that could help it happen elsewhere?
It's already happening. That's the standard in countries around the world like the Netherlands and Belgium.
And it can be abused.
When you're killing kids, killing non-ill disabled people, let's set people close to death. That is abuse. It is abuse. Yeah. They're killing they're in the Netherlands when they opened up with infanticide and legalizing it. The primary group of kids that was being killed shortly after birth was kids with spina bifida and hydrocephalus.
And so I think
and that's me.
And that's Stephanie Woodward, one of our guests for the hour. So, listen, we covered a lot of ground, and I was really moved by the phone calls and the stories shared. I have more emails I couldn't even get to. And I want to thank anyone who took the time to call or communicate with the program and know that we're going to continue to listen and share stories. And I go back to Keith's call, to value all lives and not to devalue lives. So I just want to thank our guests who are here. Stephen Drake, research analyst for Not Dead Yet. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you so much for taking the time. Stephanie Woodward, director of advocacy for the Center for Disability Rights. Thank you for being here as always, Stephanie.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.